And we're here this beautiful Sunday morning in Philadelphia, ready to go ahead with Canto 11, Chapter 3, Liberation from the Illusory Energy. We're starting with text 25 today. But first, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So in this section of the Bhagavatam, we are hearing the replies to the question of King Nimi. He asked the question in text 17, how even a foolish materialist, a stula dhiya, one with a fat head, stula actually means fat, fat head, can easily cross the illusory energy of the Supreme Lord, which is always insurmountable for those who are not self-controlled. So this is answered by the Yogendra named Prabhuda, Sri Prabhuda, in text 18 through 33. So we're up to text number 25. In the beginning of his response, he has described the nature of the illusory energy and what it's like and how it is difficult to cross over. And then beginning in text 22, he began to explain the method for this quick or easy passage in the famous verse about accepting a spiritual master in text 22. Text 21. Right. Tasmat gurum papadita snasu shreya uttamam. And so then there was another text which again describes says that one should inquire or should learn, shikshet, in text 22, the devotee whose guru atma daivatahu, who has accepted the spiritual master as his own self and as his worshipable deity. One should learn Bhagavad Dharma from him. And then the texts that follow really are all about this shikshet, what you should learn, all the things that you should learn. That verb kind of governs these texts. The various qualities are there in text 24 yesterday. There was a list, sochum, tapatatiksham, cha, maunam, swadhyayam, arjavam, and so on. So now we continue with text 25 about what one should learn. Interestingly enough, this verse 25 begins with the same word as text 23, sarvatra, sarvataha, sarvatra, sarvataha, everywhere, in every place. And 23 says that the mind should be in everywhere detached. There should be detachment of mind in regard to all things. And then, of course, it talks about asangam, detachment, and then also sangam with devotees and how to relate to them. So here, again, this is dealing with this first part, the interior dedication of a disciple, the interior and exterior, actually both in this verse. Dedication of the disciple. So the first word, the first sentence, sarvatra atma ishvara anviksham. It's like strung together as one big word in the Sanskrit. This is anviksham, which in the word for word is meditation by keeping continually in view. That is to say, oneself and the Lord. The word anviksham, the word iksh, the verb iksh is to see, and anu iksh means to follow with one's looks, to keep looking or gazing, to keep in the view. That's why it says here, meditating by keeping continually in, continuously in view. So anviksham, therefore, just means meditation, which is sustained concentration of the attention on something. So this word anviksham. So there should be this meditation, and this double vision, the double things, seeing oneself to be an eternally cognizant spirit soul, that is to say, Atma, one's true self, and Ishvara, seeing the Lord to be the absolute controller of everything. So this is important, that excuse me, that, give me a second, technical problems with the throat. This is also a machine. Atma and Ishwar, when one knows Krishna, one also knows oneself. Prabhupada has said that self-realization and God-realization go together. And when we speak of self-realization, we mean both. You can say the self with a small s and the self with a capital S in English. The capital S meaning the super self. So both of these things are in view. When the Lord is seen, then everything else is also seen. What we see in separation from the Lord is known as Maya, that which is not. That is to say, there's nothing separate from the Lord. So not only do we see ourselves in relationship to the Lord, which is our relationship to the Lord is essential, it's constitutional. It is in fact our very nature to be in relationship with the Lord, and so you can understand that denying that relationship or living outside of that relationship is a kind of ultimate suicidal violence against our own self. So that's why these two things are here together. And then it says, kaivalyam aniketatam, excuse me. These other two things are there. It says to increase one's meditation, that's added from the commentaries, one should live in a secluded place. That's kaivalyam. The word kaivalya means isolation, absolute unity, perfect isolation, detachment from all other connections, detachment of the soul from matter or transmigration. It also means liberation. It comes from the word kevala, which means something that's exclusively one's own, alone, soul, excluding others, not connecting with anything else, but the word kaivalya is also in the Bhagavatam by Prabhupada applied to the Lord. It's just a synonym of absolute, like Prabhupada says in 1.9, the purport to 1.9.21, because he is absolute, meaning the Lord, there is nothing different from him. He is Kaivalya. There is nothing except himself. So this characterization of Kaivalya to mean the Lord is also one uses of it here. But when it says to the devotee, live in a secluded place, in the commentary here, living in a secluded place indicates a place free from material disturbances, Therefore, one should live in the association of Vaishnavas, where the common goal is advancement in Krishna consciousness. Especially in Kali Yuga, if one tries to remain physically isolated from all others, the result will be degradation or insanity. So this is the Vaishnava understanding of Kaivalya, isolated from everything material or anything that distracts one from Krishna. As we'll see in later verses, very strongly emphasized here is the activities that go on in the association with devotees. They're mutually, the word mutually occurs like a lot of times, or parasparam, each other. So the association of devotees is essential to bhakti. But that's also kaivalya. Otherwise, it's true that those who are of some kind of impersonalist school, they do try to become absolutely alone. One devotee told me that before he came to Krishna consciousness, he was following some Buddhist group, and they had in California, and they had on a mountaintop sunk several deep wells. And you would be lured into the well to practice meditation. And your practice was to stay down in that well for progressively longer times. And the highest goal was to go down and never come out. So, that's a tough thing to do. And I'm sure people went crazy down there. But that's the impersonal personal version. Another one is aniketana. Mm-hmm. Aniketana, having no fixed residence, which that's in the word for word. In the running translation, it's give up false attachment to one's home and household paraphernalia. That's the understanding. In the purport to the next verse, Bhaktisiddhanta is quoted on this word. I don't know if he gave a purport to this while writing the commentary to the next verse, or whether... later on, we can see that one paragraph is actually mistakenly placed in the wrong verse. But here I'm reading from the purport to the next verse where aniketana is discussed. And in the purport it says, according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur of Mahabhagavata, a pure devotee of the Lord, is one who sees that both the material and spiritual worlds are none different from Lord Krishna, being expansions of his potency, but also sees that Rajendra Nandana, Krishna, keeps himself eternally distinct by his unique quality of all attractiveness. Thus, a pure devotee of the Lord is aniketana, without fixed residence, meaning that he accepts neither the gross nor subtle body as his eternal residence. Since one's so-called home and family are expansions of his body, such material creations are also not to be considered one's actual residence. So aniketana means that the attitude of a devotee should be that I don't live here, that I can't stay here. My own body is a temporary place. In other words, we're all homeless. Ultimately, we have a home that's in the spiritual world, but here, this is not my home. This reminded me of a song, a spiritual. I read it in a book published in the 40s. So this hymn was popularized in the 50s by Hank Williams. But there's an earlier, simpler version of this song, and it goes like this: "This world is not my home. I'm only passing through. My hopes and dreams are all beyond the blue. I've many friends and neighbors who've gone along before, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. So this should be content of spiritual realization. This world is not my home. I'm just temporary. I'm just a traveler. And my body, my family, all these things, they don't belong to me. So this is the meaning of aniketana. Without any fixed residence. Of course, in the literal way, that's also, people do this actually. Sannyasis are enjoined not to stay in any place more than 3 days, and so on. But in any case, one should practice this as a spiritual exercise. Then the next one is interesting. Vivikta Chira Vasanam. Vivikta Chira is here scraps of cloth found in unfrequented places, rags on the street. It's also this word chira sometimes it means strips of bark. Sometimes sages dress themselves in bark cloth. In other words, not to be attached to village industries and things like that, and living in the forest where you don't have looms and woven cloth. There are certain trees that you could strip the bark off, and then with kind of vines or some kind of things from leaves, weave them sew them together. And wear them, so they wear bark cloth. And you could clean it. You just dip it in the water, and it comes clean and dries, and you wear it. So this bark cloth is the dress of forest dwellers. Or it also means here torn clothes, scraps of clothes, rags that have been left behind. And again, in the purport, it said that we should actually look good if we're preachers, not look too bad. But anyway, we shouldn't be supporters of the fashion industry. And we do have thrift shops. If you have to buy Karmi clothes, you can buy things in the thrift shop. As one devotee told me when I told him my suit I had on, I got in a thrift shop. He said, "Yeah, dead man's clothes." So that's a fact. Sometimes that's what it is. But anyway, and what else is here? Santosham yena kichit, and satisfied with whatever comes. Satisfied in any material situation. One should not try too hard. There should be limits to improving one's material condition. There's a certain amount of stuff you do naturally, and that's reasonable. But if it's an over endeavor for something, it really does spoil devotional service. One becomes preoccupied with these things. Bhaktisiddhanta says what he says somewhere. He says, "When I forget the lotus feet of my spiritual master, I hurry after my bath and become busy for preventing a cold." So that kind of mentality should not be there. So then, in text 26, there are more actions and qualities of the devotee. Shraddham Bhagavate Shastre, that's the first part. Then Anindyam Anyatra Cha Apihi. This means that one should have Shraddha, firm faith, in Bhagavate Shastra, the scripture that's in connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Let's see. One should have firm faith that he will achieve all success in life by following those scriptures that describe the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. That's Bhagavate Shastra, Anindam Anyatra Chapi. And at the same time, one should avoid blaspheming other scriptures. Anyatra, other, means other texts. First, it's mentioned here, the definition of Shraddha in the commentary given by Mahaprabhu, that strong conviction, Sudriddha Nishchaya, that if I attain Krishna Bhakti, Sarva Karma Krittahoy, everything else will also be accomplished automatically. That means following the injunctions. In other words, one element of faith is, well, there's two kinds of things. Later on in the purport, there's a description of this by Madhvacharya, that this faith has two things. One, confidence in the truth of the text. And second of all, your behavior, that if I follow them, everything else will be accomplished automatically. Because faith is this is the element of faith, because as Krishna points out in the Bhagavad Gita, to be successful in devotional service, one has to have vyavasa atmika buddhi. One has to have fixed determination or single-minded. You could say vyavasa atmika buddhi really means a kind of single-mindedness of purpose. Otherwise, one's intelligence is many-branched. That is to say, I'm involved in doing many things. I practice Krishna consciousness, but I also work very hard to have money, and maybe also I'm learning martial arts, you know, and they're all equally important to me. These kinds of things, really for Krishna consciousness, one that has to be the main thing. This is the condition for success, this vyavasa atmika buddhi. And especially if one has other desires, it doesn't take place. In other words, really, one has to place one's whole life into the activities of Krishna consciousness, with a conviction that although I don't do other things, I will still be satisfied in the end. I can't think that I need Krishna consciousness and money too. I want to be rich also, because that firm faith is not there, because I think that even if I get Krishna consciousness, I'll miss out somewhere. I'll be lacking in something. So this is required. You have to have this conviction that I won't be missing in any department. Even though by dedicating, giving so much time to Krishna consciousness, I don't have time for other things. So this requires confidence. You don't really hedge your bets. No, when you go to the horse races or play in the stock market, you're advised not to put all your money on one horse or one company, but rather you should spread it out. But with Krishna consciousness, that advice doesn't apply. It doesn't mean one doesn't do other things. That's natural, that's required to be done. But everything else that we do should be subordinate to Krishna consciousness and in support of it. And if it's not in support of Krishna consciousness, it should not be done. So that's that faith. If we skip over to the paragraph 4, here's where paragraphs 4 through 7 are really in quotation marks from Madhvacharya, It says he quoted from the Brahmanda Purana. I don't know if this is his paraphrase or direct quote. One should have complete faith in the transcendental literature such as Srimad Bhagavatam and other literature that directly glorifies the personality of Godhead. The Vaishnava Tantras, the original Vedas, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, and so on. And then in the next paragraph, there are other Vedic literatures called Kala Vidya. The word Kala, with a long A at the end, means any practical art or any mechanical or fine art. These are the 64 arts listed, the famous 64 arts are Kala. If you want a list of the 64 arts, you can read the purport to 1045, 35 and 36, and there's the list of these 64 arts. So these are called Kala Vidya. So they're also in the Vedic literature. Here, quoting from Madhvacharya, since all Vedic arts and sciences are ultimately intended to be used to render devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Keshava, saintly persons in the renounced order of life should never blaspheme such apparently mundane literatures. Because such literatures are indirectly connected with the Supreme Lord, one may go to hell for blaspheming these secondary literatures. So therefore, when the texts say, not blaspheming other scriptures, this is what it's referred to. And then it goes on to say, Shraddha indicates a faithful mentality, which can be analyzed in two sections. The first type of faith is a firm conviction that all the statements of the multifarious Vedic literatures are true. In other words, the understanding that Vedic knowledge is in general infallible is called Shraddha, or faith. The second type of faith is the belief that one must personally carry out a particular injunction of Vedic literature in order to achieve his goal in life. Then it goes on, in the seventh paragraph of this purport, still quoting Madhvacharya, it looks like here's that text that's often quoted, describing what's included in the Vedic literature. The four Vedas, the original Ramayana, the Puranas, the Mahabharata are all Vedic literature. Statement here on this having Shraddham Bhagavate Shastre Anindam Anyatra Chapi Hi. And then, the other things listed here is Manu Vak Karma Dandam Cha. Dandam here means strict control over karma, vak, and mana. In other words, one's activities, one's speech, and one's mind. Satyam, one should always speak the truth. And shama dhamma api, and shama and dhamma. This is also listed in the Bhagavad Gita as brahminical qualities. Control of the mind. Shama means control of the mind, and dhamma means control of the senses. So that's the qualities of a devotee. Then it's very nice if you look at them, if you've laid numbered them. If you look at the ninth paragraph in the purport, there's a quotation from the Narada Pancharatra cited by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, which is a very nice text. Aradito yadi haris tapasa tata kim, naradito yadi haris tapasa tata kim, antar bahir yadi haris tapasa tata kim, Nantar bahir yadi haris tapasa tata kim. That is, aradito yadi haris. If one is worshipping aradita, if one is worshipping Lord Hari, tapasa tata kim. What is the use of performing penances? You know, you've already done it. Na aradito tata haris tapasa tata kim. And if you're not worshipping Lord Hari, what good are these penances? antabhaga yada haris, and if you know that Lord Hari is inside and outside, all pervading, antar and bahir yadi haris, tapasatatikim, you don't need to perform any penances and austerities. If you don't know it, they're no good to you anyway. It's a very pleasant text here. And then in the next paragraph, there's some statement in here by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur about mauna, which is in the previous verse, is one of the things, again, that saying that if one at the end of that paragraph, the chanting the holy name of the Lord, one's mauna is perfect. As we said earlier, Prabhupada said chanting Hare Krishna is silence. And then it goes on to say that one should avoid prajalpa, whimsical conversation unrelated to devotional service. Merely restraining the senses artificially won't do the job. One has to be perfectly engaged. And then the example is given that many domestic animals in the barnyard are sometimes forced to be celibate because they're kept separate from each other. So that celibacy by itself is not that big a thing. Rather, if one is practicing, such animals cannot be considered brahmacharis. So sometimes people are celibate for various reasons, but really it has to be done in connection with devotional service. Anything else here? I also quoted already from this purport about Aniniketanam, having no, one should not consider his material body to be his residence. Okay, so let's go on. We have about 10 minutes or 9 minutes. Next, we have text 27 and 28 together, which again describe the different activities of devotional service. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Dhyanam, Harer Adbhuta Karmanaha, that is to say, hearing and chanting and meditating on the wonderful pastimes of Hari, Janma Karma, Gunanam Cha, and all his pastimes, his Janma and Karma, and qualities of those pastimes. Tad arte akila chetisam, all one's endeavors, his chetisam, should be done for his sake. It says here in the verse, in the translation, thus inspired by hearing and chanting, and meditating on the pastimes of the Lord and his qualities, one should perform all of one's daily activities as an offering to the Lord. Ishtam dattam tapo japtam, that's a list. Very familiar, because actually in the first line of the purport, yat karosi yat adnashi, this is whatever one worships, ishtam, dattam, whatever charity, tapaha, whatever penance, japtam, whatever mantra one chants, vrittam, whatever pious activities you perform, should be done for Krishna. One should perform, here's the running translation, one should perform sacrifice, charity, and penance exclusively for the Lord's satisfaction. Similarly, one should chant only those mantras which glorify the Supreme Lord, and all one's religious activities should be performed as an offering to a Lord. And then there's a nice list. Whatever is dear to you, yatcha atmana priyam, whatever is dear to you, for example, dharan sutan grihan pranan, your wife, your sons, your home, and your very air of life, your own vital energy. Yet parasmai nivedanam should be an offering unto the Supreme Lord. That's a nice list there. Whenever one finds pleasing and or enjoyable, he should immediately offer to the Supreme Lord. Even his wife, children, home, and very life air, he should offer to the lotus feet of the Lord. In the second paragraph, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, these two verses indicate that all such material opulences accumulated by one's previous karma, and that's even your piety, should be used as an offering to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's the purport there. Maybe we have time. The third and the fourth paragraphs also have some further illuminations by Tapa from Vishwanath Chakravarti of observing Ekadasi, Japtam, chanting the holy names of the Lord, and so on. But let's go on and do text number 29. This is a little difficult in the Sanskrit. I got some help from Dvijamani here. Evam krishnatma na teshu manyushyeshu chaso hridam paricharyam chobayatra mahatsu nishu sadushu. So there's no verb here, but it means again that one should learn these things, and that means that there should be sohridam, suhrit. There should be a friendliness among the, well, there's different ways to read this, but Krishnatma Nateshu means friendship with those people among the humans, society, Manusheshu, who are Krishnatma Nata, who have accepted Krishna as their Atma, their soul, and as their Lord. Or the other reading is that one should accept Krishna as the Lord of their life, as their Lord of the life. So that means devotees. However, if in the next text, the final paragraph, this belongs actually to this verse. I think it's just misplaced in the editing process, where it says, Srila Madhvacharya has pointed out that just as one should cultivate friendship with devotees, one must cultivate a spirit of friendship toward the demigods who manage the universe on the Lord's behalf. See, Madhvacharya reads Krishnatma Nata as the devas. That's more important maybe to him than it is to us today as a follower of Lord Chaitanya. Thus one should live peacefully within this world. So this really doesn't fit the next verse. It goes on here. And so then paricharyam, one should render, it says here, service. Service to ubayatra, that is to say, to both. And some It says here in the word for word, moving and non-moving creatures or the Lord and his devotees. That's because some commentators say both is moving and non-moving creatures, and other commentators say Ubaya means the Lord and his devotees. And it applies in all cases. There should be this sense of service. And then they're especially singled out as Mahatsu, Rishu, and Sadushu. This is in the plural, unto the Mahat, the Nrishu, the human beings, and Sadhu, to the Sadhus. So this is understood to be, as it says here in the one should especially try to help those in the human form of life, Nrishu, even if it's to even moving and unmoving beings, you should, but especially Nrishu, those who are human beings. Prabhupada was asked, when Lord Chaitanya made the tigers dance and chant, that we should also cultivate a devotional service for the animals. And he said, we are not as powerful as Mahaprabhu, and we should mostly direct our preaching toward the animal-like human beings. Those tigers among men who are... especially to the human beings, and then among them, those who are sadhus. Sadhus mean people who are generally pious, according to the understanding here. And then mahatsu, the mahats here are understood to be the pure devotees. So that's the list of, again, of relationships, friendship and service that one should follow. Okay, I guess we have to stop now. Next week, text 30 is a wonderful text. 31 is a very important text, quoted many, many times, has the phrase bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya, that's quoted many times, that how bhakti produces, is born of bhakti. So we're coming to, and then we're coming to the end of the instructions of Prabhuda, and we ends with the perfection of devotional service in these final texts. Okay, so now I will switch to the question and answer mode. By the way, I should just tell you that we are graced with the presence of His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami, who walked in the beginning of this. He's visiting our temple here, and we're very inspired to have him with us, however briefly. He also has no fixed residence. Aniketana. Okay, let me switch over to the question and answer mode. So now everyone is silent, but those who are able to unmute themselves one at a time, if there's any questions or comments. You have to unmute yourself. You have to press star 6. I can hear a small child in the background.
Yeah, I unmuted my phone, Guru Maharaj. It's Mahalini. Please accept my humble obeisances.
Hare Krishna, Mama.
I thought I'd wait a minute, though, and try to muffle the microphone if anybody else had any questions. So I usually get in on it.
Well,
so
you heard first, I guess. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a question.
Harold,
and
sound of children.
we're right now walking over a bridge in Austin looking at the river. My question, there's a few, but I guess the main one is sometimes I've seen devotees say something like the following. You know, I gave as much as I could to Krishna consciousness, and now I'm frustrated because I didn't develop certain things, and now it's late in life, and I'm kind of struggling like heck because I repressed needs I had early on, or something like that. And my question, what made me think about this is the focus on vyavasyatmaka buddhi, mm-hmm. and the need to completely give ourselves to our spiritual practice if we're going to have any kind of success. Mm-hmm. And my question is, when you hear things like that, it seems like there's a few ways to understand it. One of them is that this person maybe did legitimately renounce beyond their qualification in a way, because renunciation has to be done kind of with some cognizance of someone's needs? Or do you see it more that maybe these people aren't actually engrossed in their spiritual lives the way they used to be, and therefore they're just not happy, and they read that unhappiness into their current circumstances?
I think in most cases it's the latter. It's true that in the early days of the movement we are sometimes not very good at giving people appropriate spiritual guidance. Nevertheless, if you ever gave yourself wholeheartedly to the practice of the Krishna consciousness, and later on you discovered that, you know, that may have created some material hardship, if one actually has the attitude that it was not a loss, it was the best thing I could have done with my time, which is true, then with that attitude, I think you'll discover that if you just go to Krishna, that please help me, I'm in a little difficult position now because, you know, I dropped out of school and, you know, I'm 35 years old and I don't have a job. That Krishna he's in control, you know, I mean, he really is, and he takes care of his devotees. He really does. But you have to let him. If you said, oh, you know, Krishna dealt with me badly and now I'm on the streets with no money and now I have to take care of myself, if that's the attitude, you know, you can't expect that Krishna, not being invited to help, will do things. But if one has the attitude of surrender to Krishna, I'm sure Krishna comes to your rescue. And I've also seen that many, many times. There's a lot of devotees I know now who, you know, for so many years lived in the temple and ashram. Either they're brahmacharis or extremely renounced householders, and then found out later, you know, they had a family, had to support them, and they were on the streets. And they've done very well, actually. It's not the universal experience like this, and I suspect one of the indicators of that is simply the attitude of not resenting, not begrudging any service you've done for Krishna. So even if your service to Krishna, you find yourself as a result in a difficult position, you shouldn't give up that, you know, I made a mistake, or I was tricked, or I was misled. And certainly that attitude is not an indication of, like, really good spiritual practice.
Yeah.
Because if you still connect with Krishna, you can never see things that way. And it's true, you know, I mean, if a person is not in Krishna consciousness, then things look pretty rough. Things look pretty hopeless. And then, you know, the person will then say, oh, you know, it's the fault of the GBC, it's the fault of the gurus, it's the fault of, you know, everything looks bad, and then you blame others. This is not healthy, spiritually healthy, nor materially healthy, for that matter. And even if people made mistakes, even if the leadership was not so good, and maybe it would have been a wiser course to do something else, you just accepted it somehow or other, that it's I had all this advantage of service to Krishna, and even though I didn't prepare for my future, I should still understand that if I was sincerely serving Krishna, there's no loss, and Krishna will really certainly carry what I like and preserve what I have. Okay?
That wasn't autobiographical by God's grace. In fact, I had the wonderful experience of actually finding that in certain circumstances, Krishna consciousness made me more prepared materially, shockingly, particularly when I started taking Sanskrit and I had all the samskaras from Sanskrit language in my mind. Mm-hmm. I actually reflect on the fact that, wow, living in the ashram actually gave me a material qualification that my other fellow students don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And
actually,
so anyway.
People have lots of material qualifications other people don't have. like at least a modicum of renunciation.
Yeah.
If you retain that, you can do better than everybody else whose mind and senses are uncontrolled like crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the discipline too, absolutely. That was also my experience, just the kind of discipline we have and been happily trained to have.
My own son, you know, who basically, you know, finished up in a gurukula at the age of 16, having essentially a medieval education, found himself, was able to, you know, do pretty well because he had learned something that all the people from the number one high schools hadn't learned, that is how to read and write properly. You know, the medieval education was very, very good. Better than the modern ones.
Sorry?
Better than the modern ones.
Yeah. One other thing, too, that I think is dangerous about that kind of blaming one's early guides in Krishna consciousness or something is people forget that they made choices. They weren't forced to join the ashrama, even if maybe they got a hard sell. And it seems there's something really unhealthy about making oneself a victim of circumstance. Anyway, that's just a little editorial. Sorry. Thank you, Guru Maharaj.
Okay. Anyone else? Any other questions or comments? There's an in-house studio audience question or comment.
Ravindra Saru Prabhu?
Oh, there's one here coming. Okay. Yeah.
This is Rasikya calling from Austin.
Hi, Krishna.
Yeah, I enjoyed listening to that last question because I've heard so much of that.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
And I can't remember who said it, but I read it recently where a quote about blaming. You can call yourself mature once you stop blaming.
You can call yourself a what?
You can't call yourself mature.
Mature, I see.
Or an adult until you stop blaming.
Yeah, sure. So, it's certainly not healthy.
Yeah, really.
By the way, welcome back to Germany. Did you have a nice trip?
Yeah, I did. It was, actually, I went because I thought my mother was going to leave her body.
Mm-hmm.
But with all of us there, she regained new life. And she's doing really well. And
I'm glad she found her children worth staying around for.
Yeah,
people may be like, hey, she's out of this world.
And the nice thing was that she kept asking me, what shall I do?
Mm-hmm.
And So she said, do you have a prayer book? And I said, yeah, I do, but I don't know if it is a prayer that's going to appeal to you. So you have to find a prayer that appeals to you.
Mm-hmm.
And she did visit the temple one time, and because of her intellectual and arrogant side, she couldn't, you know, quite accept the simplicity of Krishna consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But she did chant. And now, at the end of her life, she's saying, I put myself in your hands, tell me what to do.
Very good.
Yeah. So that was really nice, so we've been working on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Prabhupada pointed out that when somebody becomes a devotee, it benefits everyone in their family.
Yeah, even if they don't exactly take to it, there's some kind of respect, just a simple respect for the other is gainful, I think.
Yeah, well, that's good. Okay.
Anyway, I also wanted to say in regards to, different choices that we've made. I've made so many different choices in my life that I might not have done if I could redo them. But because of my attachment, I guess, for the years that I was there, I luckily don't have any bitterness.
Good. Somehow or other, it is human life is set up that when we're very, very young and idiots, we have to make like our really important decisions, like, you know, what should my vocation be, who should I get married to, all these kind of things. We have to decide this at a very young age.
Yeah.
And if it were just backwards, if we could somehow or other make those decisions when we're 50 or 60 years old, you know.
Could I redo that, please?
Yeah, you know. But that's the way it is. I suppose, if you have a really traditional, as we say, Vedic culture, you know, you would have elders you could trust who could give you proper guidance when you really need it. Unfortunately, we don't have that right now, and that's the difficulty.
Yeah.
And in the early days of the movement, you know, I've said this about it, that not only was Prabhupada the only pure devotee, he was the only grown-up.
Yeah, that's true. And even some of my devotees that I asked for guidance, sometimes I didn't get the right guidance either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about approaching the right person,
mm-hmm.
the qualified person.
Yeah, but even we have to understand that ultimately we're dealing with Krishna.
Exactly.
And if we take shelter of Krishna, even if, you know, in different ways it seemed like we were put into difficult conditions, we would, we'll come. He'll take care of us.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we have another question here.
Okay, thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Very well.
And this is from the Purport 2.11.326. You didn't comment on it, but it's a warning from Bhaktisiddhanta, where he says that mundane faith in godless ethics is spiritually suicidal.
Where is this?
This is one of the last paragraphs. I haven't numbered them, but...
Yeah, okay.
Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has warned us that if one becomes attracted to non-theistic ethical philosophies, such as those of the Buddhists and Jains, which glorify such mundane principles as ahimsa or non-violence, that's the point. So, it's been noted in Islam that we tend to leap from the sinful to the transcendental by passing the ethic of the human sometimes. So I would...
Wait a minute, I'm having a hard time. I think I'll... Just a second.
Okay.
I can
listen
to this
one. Oh, okay.
On the phone or not both.
Right.
Sure.
Okay. So in light of that paragraph, I was just wondering that since it's been noted sometimes in our movement that we tend to leap from sinful to the transcendental, bypassing the human and the ethical, How, if you could elaborate on Bhaktisiddhanta's warning here, that faith in this godless ethics is spiritual suicidal, what would godless ethics be as opposed to pious ethics?
What would godless ethics be as opposed to piety? I think what this means is that... Prabhupada said there's no harm in being a Mayavadi, or say just an impersonalist, if one hasn't heard about Krishna. But sometimes, it's understandable. But if one thinks that these are can compete with or substitute for actual Krishna consciousness, then your spiritual advancement is going to be hampered. That's my general understanding. The idea that, that's a complicated thing, but the idea that somehow, you know, you can be perfectly ethical and moral without God consciousness, I mean, this is often, case is often made now. I don't believe in God, but I'm decent, you claim. and that this idea of that morality is necessarily linked to theism. On that particular score, I have my doubts. I think years ago I read a short story by John Updike, in which he described a New England, little town in New England, and people are going to church every Sunday. They've lost their faith, they have no belief, but still they go to church every Sunday. And he says, from this they achieve a kind of peace and stability that they have no right to anymore. So I think a lot of morality is still here as a kind of aftershock of an earlier theism. And when that theism is gone entirely, when the reverberations of it the ripples have finally dissipated, you're going to see that actually we need it. That's my conviction. And people say that we go on without God and are moral. That's just because you're living on the spiritual credit of earlier generations. And when it runs out, watch out. Okay? Anything else? All right, so then we'll bring this class to a close. And so next class, we'll start with text number 30. Really 30, 31, and 32 are the conclusion of the teachings of instructions of Prabuddha, and then 33 is a kind of a coda, and then 34 the next question of King Maharaj Nimi. So I'll be in touch with all of you by the miracles of modern communications. next Sunday morning. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.